Hey, I'll Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Express and ScottHorton.org. Oh, man, I meant to join up the chat room during the break. Well, I'll get around to it. That's just ScottHorton.org/chat if you're interested in that. Our first guest on the show today is Michael Kelly from Business Insider, businessinsider.com. And boy, does he have some interesting stories to talk with us about. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Tell us all about Arnon Milchin. Am I saying his name right?
Yeah.
All right. So what's the news?
Well, he's one of the most prolific Hollywood producers from in the last 3 or 4 decades. He's still working. He produced movies like Natural Born Killers, Pretty Woman, Fight Club, L.A. Confidential. And
I apologize to everyone. I know nothing about movie stuff, so maybe this guy is a household name, but I just have never heard of him.
Yeah, he's for people who know Hollywood producers, he certainly is. There have been rumors for years. There's this book called Confidential that said that he lived a double life as an Israeli intelligence operative. Last week he confirmed to Israel's Channel 2 that, in fact, that's what he was working as a spy for decades as he was working in Hollywood.
Mm. And this isn't just a made-up movie script?
No, this guy's the real deal.
All right, so now, what was his job, and for how long did this go on?
He was recruited when he was in his 20s, so that would be the 1960s, essentially. He's friends with, he's longtime friends with current Israeli president Shimon Peres, Benjamin Netanyahu. At least he spoke about doing this work in the 60s for LACOM, which is Israel's very secretive economic espionage unit. And so he did this through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and perhaps into the 80s.
Now, this is a story that you've been writing about since, Grant Smith originally broke it back in the summer of 2012. Now, was it already out at that point about this movie producer's role in it, or... we're only finding out that now, or how's that work?
Yeah, not really. Smith does note that the essentially what happened is that an American company sent 800 over the course of 5 years, 1979 to 1983, sent 800 triggers for nuclear weapons through Milchan's company to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. And Smith points out that he was recruited by Arnon Milchan in meetings with Benjamin Netanyahu, who was working for Milchan's company in Israel, mm-hmm. and how the operation was rolled up after this American was indicted for smuggling. And so it was out there, but since, you know, he never confirmed it, once he confirmed it, it kind of came back in the light, and it's really once you know both stories, it's really amazing how high up this guy was working while he was also very high up in Hollywood.
Right. And now, so part of what he does, his job was economic espionage, and so I guess I'm not exactly clear what all that means, but that included brokering all sorts of arms deals for a very long time, correct?
Right, weapons deals. He started out by, he told Channel 2 that he, at one point he was operating 30 companies, so they're front companies, in 17 different countries. So front companies all over the place. And, yeah, he talks about being involved in a lot of arms deals in the 70s. Nuclear Triggers, his company, was in the middle of that in the late 70s and early 80s. So he was really involved in the highest forms of smuggling for decades.
Mm-hmm. And before we get back to that, do you know much about... what else, you know, could you give us examples of what kind of economic espionage you were talking about, like trade secrets from manufacturing firms or banks or that kind of stuff, or what?
Oh, well, yeah, anything. I'm not an expert on LACOM. I think of Grant Smith's book, because through LACOM, they were able to get 22 tons of highly enriched uranium. So that's about the most prized possession for any country that is looking at nuclear power or looking to build a nuclear warhead. It's exactly what Israel and the United States and Western powers are trying to stop Iran from getting, is highly enriched uranium. And LACOM, through a company called NUMEC, got 22 tons of this, pretty much enough to build most of Israel's arsenal between 1957 and 67. So anything from that down that they wanted, you can set up a shell company and try to get it, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And now, it's a very interesting story, too, and I really appreciate how you link back to all of Grant's work on it. Well, I mean, to the book, but also what he's written at the EARMIP site there. With all the sources, source documents and all of that. But I know it's kind of difficult. I'm not even sure if I could follow. But I'd like to try to give you a chance anyway, if you could, to explain who was working for who, what role Milchin played in introducing who to who, and exactly how it is. I think, as you say in there, there's paraphrasing or even quoting Grant Smith, that there's actually no smoking gun about this, but there are, what, empty shell casings laying around all over the floor, something like that?
As far as NUMEC goes, yeah. It was essentially, there could NUMEC and Zalman Shapiro, that story is both connected to Ralph Eaton, who ran Ralph Eaton ran the jailed spy Jonathan Pollard, who's the most famous U.S. spy or caught spying on the U.S. ever, and he's still imprisoned. And Eaton and LACOM's chief Benjamin Bloomberg were the ones that recruited Milchan, actually. As far as NUMEC went, Zalman Shapiro was a brilliant, brilliant man. He helped build the world's first operational nuclear power submarine in 1954 for the USS Nautilus. And eventually he created NUMEC in 56, and essentially from the start it was used to funnel nuclear materials to Israel. Rafi Eitan visited there, and David Lowenthal, an American citizen, another American citizen who secretly fought for Israel during the 48 War for Independence, traveled on its behalf. And so it simply had a network that was slightly hidden from view for years, and Shapiro obviously did great things for the U.S. Navy, and over time they were able to funnel all of this this nuclear material out somehow. And when Smith talks about no single smoking gun is because you can't. He does a great job in the book. He has the exact what left Numac and in what cans, but the how poorly this was documented or investigated at the time, you can't really say who did what where. But there are some really interesting interviews and documents in that book that really build what would be circumstantial evidence to this front company funneling highly enriched uranium to Israel.
Yeah, I was surprised that one of the things that you mentioned there was, or maybe it was him, I reread one of his articles this morning too, one of the ones that you linked to there, but where he talks about Anthony Kordsman, the famous, I forgot which think tank he's at, but very establishment, perhaps center-left realist-type foreign policy analyst guy. That's what I mostly know him as anyway. But in a former life in the 1980s, he said that there was no explanation for what these guys were doing there other than diverting uranium.
Right, yeah. He said there's no conceivable reason for Rafi Eitan to have gone to NUMEC. And he said that in 1986 because Rafi Eitan's the top spy in Israel. So why is he going to a small town in Pennsylvania?
And who was Kordsman at the time when he said that? Do you know?
He was studying the Middle East as an analyst. So he was a Middle East operative analyst.
I see.
So he's watching this, the world unfold, and he notices this and points out that there's no way that there's no reason really for Israel's top spy to be there.
Mm. And then I thought it was funny. It was just the contrast. I was reading this thing about how people call 911 on each other all day long. And then I read this thing about, for nothing, right? There's no cheese on my burger kind of stuff. And then I read about, it's funny. I did see some Israelis with some giant drums of highly enriched uranium loading it on a ship and sailing it away. Now that you mention it, FBI agents who are asking me about it 15 years later or whatever it was. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's an interesting time in history, in American history, in Israel's history, that such an operation could happen. And hindsight's 2020, and it's easy, but it's 22 tons of highly enriched uranium from Pennsylvania to Israel. It is amazing, and I'm sure that some people in the government know a lot about this. And in the FBI, that are embarrassed and mind blown, essentially, by how it happened.
Mm. And you know what? I'm terrible. I'm going to bring this up, but I don't know the answer, but I should. I asked Grant once about, maybe Johnson knew about it and said it was okay and had the CIA provide cover for it, kind of thing like that. It was just a covert op, and that's how they got away with it. And then he actually came back to me with an answer about that, but I don't remember what it was. I think it was an indication that perhaps that was true, but I bet he's listening right now cringing because I don't remember.
Yeah, I would be interested. I forget myself about what he said about the administrations after Kennedy, because Kennedy was very, very much against Israel's nuclear program, and Johnson was a little more. He held them in a little more favor, and certain things did go back on the uptick after Kennedy was assassinated and such, but. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of people, a lot of things that could be known about this that aren't known about it.
Yeah. Well, now, Project Pinto, that wasn't the FBI investigation. That was the Israeli covert op, correct?
I believe that Project Pinto was about the nuclear triggers.
Uh-huh. Not the diversion of the uranium, but just the Krytrons.
Right.
Right. And now, so what was current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's role in that?
According to these FBI documents that IRMAP got a hold of, the U.S. the president of Milco, this company that brokered the trade of the nuclear triggers, met with Milchan and Netanyahu at points, who was working for the smuggling front Healy Trading, the Milchan Brothers Trading Company, which is Milchan's company. On the Israeli side. So he was part working for the company that was the reported middle way between this California company and Israel's Ministry of Defense.
Mm. And now, again, these Krytrons, they're just switches. They're not nuclear material, but they're forbidden for export, right? And then, as you said earlier, the company that produced these things and helped smuggle them to Israel, they ended up getting prosecuted, right? Or at least their leader did?
Yeah, the U.S. indicted and extradited President Kelly Smith on 30 counts of smuggling, making false statements, because these things that could be used as nuclear triggers require a U.S. State Department munitions license to be exported, and the U.S. had denied multiple licenses for Israel prior to that. So however they got there, and they bypassed the export needing for a munitions license. They were smuggled out.
And now remind me, do you know when the FBI investigation of this started? Because it seems like a lot going on. Again, we already talked about this, but it's not, they didn't just look at this after the fact, did they? When this went on for a decade, right?
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, in Grant's book, he discusses how people were on this trail even in the 60s and 70s, but there was a lot of, there wasn't much sharing of information. You have the FBI and the CIA, and you kind of have people getting hushed up along the way, and that could be helpful in certain ways. The documents that IRMEP got, they're from the early 90s, talking about this Project Pinto. FBI agents and nuclear officials had spoken with Zalman Shapiro, who was running NUMEC. They were talking to him all the time. They knew him, so they were asking him questions and stuff. So they were involved. It's just they never got wise to it, essentially.
Right. All right. Again, it's Michael Kelly from Business Insider. And I see here that you've got this article about the Stuxnet attack, and about more that's being found out about the, I guess, medium term so far, effects of this virus. Can you, I guess, first of all, remind the audience what Stuxnet was, and then what's changed in the story, what we already knew from the David Sanger and the rest of them?
Yes, Stuxnet is known as a joint U.S.-Israeli project that caused Iran, about a fifth of Iran's nuclear centrifuges to spin out of control. So people, the NSA says that it's widely considered the claim that it set Iran's nuclear program back 2 years. What was not known about it, and what this cybersecurity expert Ralph Langer wrote in Foreign Policy, was that Stuxnet attack of the centrifuge and spinning out of control was actually the second part of the attack, and it was much simpler than the first attack. The first attack essentially was had to be put in by a human agent, a double agent, someone that was around facilities, and it created a blueprint. It slowly infiltrated all the systems, and it wasn't meant to destroy something. That wasn't its intended effect. Its intended effect was to go throughout the entire system. And it was wildly complex. Langer says that the coding was so far out, it leads one to wonder whether its creators might have been on drugs. It's something that no one has ever seen before. Only when they found this second version of Stuxnet did they notice that there was a first one at all. So they essentially could have been doing this for even longer without an offensive attack like the second version to actually cause things to spin out of control. And what's amazing about that is that what Langer concludes is that all these industrial control systems that a military facility or normal facility like water and electricity. This attack showed that if you go to the weakest link, which is the human beings, the contractors working for these places, you can hypothetically insert something that could infect it for years and could essentially be followed up by something that could attack it, which is pretty daunting for cybersecurity researchers.
Right. Well, it's interesting what you say about they must have been tripping or something. I guess it must have been the CIA behind that thing, because they probably got the monopoly on LSD production in this country anyway. No.
There was probably no one as talented. It probably had to be the biggest talents, which would be the NSA and Israel's Unit 8200. He said that there were things in there that hackers could only dream of, as far as what they could do. This is at the it's widely known that this was a government-backed operation.
Right, and now, so I think I saw a thing a couple of weeks ago about how Stuxnet is living on and it's infecting all kinds of things around the world. Nobody knows what it's going to do. I mean, I don't think anybody's saying it's going to turn into Skynet and kill us all yet, but it's apparently, Norton doesn't have a patch for that thing yet, right?
Yeah, and Langer discussed this a little bit, and he said that it seems that the people that created Stuxnet kind of wanted the second version to go out. They didn't mind. The second one, you didn't need a human carrier. It was injected in, and then it was itself replicated on all sorts of computers. So it would jump networks and go all over, and was essentially spreading and also collecting information about all sorts of computers it was jumping to. It spread, and so you have the implication is that you have a state-sponsored piece of malware that was intended to spread outside of the target's computers and just go into the wild. And there was a report that a Russian astronaut had accidentally taken it up to the International Space Station. Just a potential example of what the implication of that is if something goes into the wild like that, and something is relatively complex as that. So it's out there.
Well, but I mean, the market will provide, right? Somebody's got to get really high and write the Stuxnet killer, right?
Yeah, good luck. Good luck with
what happened to that?
They would have to be the best that there is.
It's really it's not just that it's so good at doing what it does and so hard to find, but it's that hard to kill, too.
Well, the Iranians said that they were able to neutralize it, notice it, neutralizing it, and it, at some point it would make sense that they would, because it was the second version was such an offensive weapon that you could perhaps see and adapt quickly. But the daunting thing about it is that first attack, they didn't know for years. And cyber research don't even exactly know how long it was going on. Something so brilliant and so under the radar, it makes you wonder what other very complex viruses are out there that no one has noticed yet.
Yeah, well, I wonder, Greenwald keeps saying, I guess as recently as a month or 6 weeks ago or something, that, oh no, all the big stories we're still holding on to for now, which, hurry up, but I guess we may find out something like that. What do you think? Think that's probably in there? What other kind of viruses they've done along these lines?
That is a really interesting question. If the Snowden cache of documents has these offensive Olympic Games type worms in there, I would think that he wouldn't have access to something that far up the chain. But I've been blown away by some of these leaks already. So, it's not out of the question if he reportedly took the blueprints of the NSA, he probably took as many offensive offensive files as possible as well.
Yeah, I really wonder about that. I mean, 20,000 documents. I don't know if that means pages exactly or if it really means 20,000 documents, but I guess this thing could go on for years. And would it be, is it a correct frame of reference at all that the offensive capabilities and the vacuum up everything in the world capabilities that we see that we could categorize in our own head as kind of separate missions of the NSA, are they really that separate inside the NSA where somebody like Snowden might not have access to that offensive stuff at all? That's all going on in a different building under different control, or we just might imagine that?
There is a certain bit of overlap because the NSA has both an offensive and defensive mission, which is a bit contradictory because there's the argument that they insert malware and weaken the internet for their offensive purposes. So they're weakening the defense of the infrastructure for offensive purposes.
Right.
There are very elite, the Dow hackers, TAO, and the most offensive elite hackers in the NSA. They're separated in Hawaii, where Snowden took most of those documents. They're separated by an air gap, so he wouldn't be able to get to the most sensitive offensive operations, I don't think. But that being said, there is chatter that he does have information about generally about what they do, Scott Shane wrote a great very long, wonderful New York Times piece a couple weeks ago about his thoughts on the NSA documents and what he learned from it. And he notes the Dow hackers and some things, but he just generally touches on it. So there's a hint that that stuff is there and it's very sensitive material, and it's in there, but it may not be something that the public would find out because it's not necessarily in the public interest to be revealing those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that he's got the NSA dossiers on the House and the Senate. I want all their dirty laundry all over every website, because this is all their responsibility, so they should be the worst victims of it, right? Doesn't that make sense?
The political, potential political dirt angle is quite interesting here.
I mean, that's why they created the NSA in the first place, was to blackmail Congress into giving NSA more money, right?
Well, it would be a vicious cycle to start. I mean, Hoover started that trend, so you have the...
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. The music's cutting in here. We got to go. I'm talking all over your interview. I'm sorry, Michael. Thank you very much for a great interview and great work here at BusinessInsider.com. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Every day.
All right. That's Michael Kelly at Business Insider writing all about Arnon Milchan, the Israeli spy, Hollywood movie producer, and Stuxnet, too. And we'll be right back. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up. Turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've Got to Read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.